Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit the webpage, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the common law right after this. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then you pay 17% income tax on the same $50,000. Now, that's another $8,500. That means you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. Now, that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? If you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on the email, send an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Hey, we're talking about the common law. Where'd it come from? Who thunk it up? We found out that God thunk it up, gave it to Moses. Alfred the Great codified it into what's called the English Common Law. He did that in 872 A.D. A neat book, of course, was written called Missing Links Discovered by E. Raymond Capp. Chapter 12 tells us a little bit more of the study. It was published by Artisan Sales. I'll just give you the information. Thousand Oaks, California, published by Artisan Sales. E. Raymond Capp is the author. Library of Congress catalog card number is 84-72637. I think if you went to a used bookstore, you could probably just ask for Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets by E. Raymond Capp, 1985. Probably get that book for you. Now, that'll give you a little historical, archaeological help in finding this thing called the common law. Where did it come from? Who thought it up? And so on. Then, once we get that under our belts, then there's four or five other aspects that this common law delves into, or the common law participates in, or comes from this practice that we call law. You know, we're always concerned about OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Social Security, parking tickets, buckling our seat belts. You know, everything in life is regulated by law. Now, when God gave us the law out at Mount Sinai, it was a total of 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. The last time I looked, the United States, the 50 states, and all of our city councils and 3,500 counties, county commissioners, have given us 2.5 million laws here in the United States. 2.5 million. God runs the entire universe on 759. Now, that's the epitome of limited government. If you want the greatest limited government ever devised on planet Earth by the mind of God Himself, it was the law of Moses, the law of God, the Ten Commandments and the supporting statutes. Now, that's the most limited form of government you can have, and there's a very important reason for that. Every law that's enacted impairs somebody's liberty to some degree. Now, many times laws are enacted that do not necessarily impact upon you directly. For instance, the other day I read about a law that was enacted down in Florida. It's called the State Minimum Wage Law. I read about this, the Mogambo Guru newsletter from Kitco. It had this little story in there. You see, the national minimum wage law is $5.15 an hour. So the Florida legislature, or worse than that, I think it was a general initiative. The Florida voters, they said, we got to have $6.15 an hour. So the minimum wage in Florida is a dollar an hour more than the national. And evidently the people of Florida must think that's a wonderful law. It's terrific. Now, I guess at first glance when we say, well, we need more money, I guess that sounds pretty good. Now, I think that the problem isn't more money. I think the problem is the loss of value of the money that you got. See, I don't want more money. I want less. I want less and less money with greater and greater value. So there was a time when I used to deal in Federal Reserve notes. And when I was making, I used to make $3.27 an hour. I was at the top of my craft. I was a machinist. I belonged to the machinist union. I mean, I had arrived. It's like the millennium. It's like going to heaven. It's like dying and going to heaven. When you're a machinist and you got seniority in the company that you're working for, and I was making $3.27 an hour. Let me plug that into my Texas Instruments Sharp calculator here. And $3.27 an hour times 2,000 hours a year. I was making $6,540 a year. And I said to myself, now that's not enough money. I need to make $7,000 a year. And sure enough, one day I got to making $7,000, and then $8,000, and $10,000, and I was never satisfied. Never, never was I ever satisfied. I don't care if I was making $10,000, I wanted to make $20,000. If I was making $20,000, I wanted to make $40,000. If I was making $40,000, I wanted to make $80,000. You know? So, and I kept making more and more. And every time I'd make more and more, I'd get further and further behind her. It's a little story, you know? The harder I work, the behinder I get. That's where this minimum wage thing is going. Because, you see, most of the people that are working for minimum wage work for McDonald's or other service companies like that. So McDonald's raised everything on their menu in Florida by 5 cents. Now, that's good for McDonald's. And McDonald's can justify that by saying simply, gee, we have to pay a dollar an hour more for the laborers that are making your Big Macs. So therefore, we got to raise the price of the Big Mac from $1.34 to $1.39. And you're sitting there saying, well, okay, it's only a nickel. Well, that dollar an hour isn't costing McDonald's a nickel for the Big Mac. It's costing them a penny. So when they raise the price by 5 cents, they increase the profit margin on their product by about five times what they're paying out. So it was wonderful. It was a hell of a deal for McDonald's. Here's what it does for the worker. Because the worker who was making $5.15, because the legislature, because of this general law which impacts the entire state, everybody in the state's going to raise his prices. Now, if McDonald's was getting $1.35 or something like that for a hamburger, and they raised the price a nickel, it probably raised the price of 2 or 3%. Well, the wage earner over here, he got a raise in pay, but he also has to pay more Social Security and more income tax. In fact, of his 14 taxes, he's got to pay those 14 taxes on that $1. So he didn't get a dollar an hour raise to start with. He didn't get a buck an hour raise to start with. Because 16 cents is going to come out of that right off the top for Social Security, and then another 17 cents for tax, income tax. And then there's all the other taxes. He's got his property taxes, and if the guy's renting an apartment, he's paying the property taxes in his rent. Don't ever believe for a moment that the landlord is paying the property tax. He writes the check and delivers it. The tenants pay it. He's just the collection agency for the county that collects the property tax and pays it over to the county. So the ultimate payer is the guy that's doing the work. And the ultimate guy that's doing the work is the guy that's flipping the burgers there. So he got a dollar an hour raise, and when he gets all through, he's going to come up with less purchasing power than he had with $5.15. So out of the $5.15, he probably had, you know, 35, 40, 50%, let's give him 50% of that as purchasing power. Now, when he gets $6.15, it's going to go down to 47, 48, 49%. Every time you get a raise, you lose purchasing power. Sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? Until you get off of commercial paper, until you get into just weights and balances, until you start dealing in hard money. Now, I deal in gold and silver coin. I conduct my business. When you go to school here, you pay your tuition in gold coin. I know it's a wild, crazy concept, but then this is a wild and crazy school. And as a result of that, I don't conduct my business in Federal Reserve notes, so I don't conduct my business in Social Security, Federal Reserve, or income tax script. We don't do business in United States dollars. We do business in gold dollars, not Federal Reserve note dollars. And as a result of that, when you get off of this minimum wage and this government and the guarantees, this guardian ward relationship with the state, and you take on a new concept called individual responsibility. Who's going to be responsible for George Gordon? The state of Florida or George Gordon? Now, once you learn how to become independent and responsible for your own actions, you can start to make money, conserve purchasing power, live your life free from the kinds of constraints dictated by an insane asylum or by an institution like government. Now, if you need to be institutionalized, you know, then so be it. I mean, if you need to go to a mental hospital because you need to be institutionalized, that's what they're there for. But if perchance you think that you might be able to make it out here in the real world all by yourself, responsible for your own actions, and you'd like to get discharged from the mental hospital, the law school is the place to go to learn how. So let's take up the Limited Liability Act of 1851. We're talking about limited liability. Well, limited liability is insurance. Limited liability is insurance. Insurance is the opposite of strict liability. Strict liability is what we get from the Bible. God requires everybody to be strictly liable for all of their own actions. And, of course, that can get expensive. I mean, you could have an accident out here and cause somebody some damages and end up being a bondservant, you know, for the rest of your life. And it was because of events like that that triggered Americans, and I'm sure Canadians and Australians and New Zealanders and the rest of us, to rethink this thing of strict liability. You see, under strict liability, you have maximum freedom, but you have to be responsible for all of your actions. You have to buy every kid you kill in the school zone. You got to buy every kid you kill. So you need to drive through the school zone very cautiously so that you don't kill anybody's kid. Well, this concept of insurance got its start in 1851 here in the United States in our legal system. See, up until 1851, we all practiced the common law. We all practiced strict liability. And here's the story. It's called, in the case, the New Jersey Steam Navigation Company versus the Merchants Bank, cited at 6 Howard 342, decided in 1848. The United States Supreme Court ruled that under the common law, ship owners were liable for the acts of their shipmasters. Oh, my God. Ship owners are responsible for the acts of the ship captains. In other words, if a party were to ship goods on board a ship and something happened to the goods, such as being destroyed or damaged by the perils of the sea, the ship owner was responsible to the owner of the goods. And the ship owner must pay to the owner of the goods the amount that the goods were worth. And if the ship owner didn't pay the debt, the owner of the goods could sue the ship owner and collect. So if the ship owner failed to pay, the creditor could then file a lien on the ship, which is called a maritime lien, and which does not require possession of the object. Whew, we can't have that. Well, that's un-American. We've got to have something. You know, what? An American be responsible and liable for the damages that he causes his customers or clients? It would be like a doctor operating on your appendix, cutting out your gallbladder, and you sue the doctor and require that the doctor be responsible. That's why we have medical malpractice insurance. That's so that doctors don't have to be responsible for their mistakes. That's why we have auto insurance policies. People that drive automobiles don't want to be responsible for their own mistakes. Now, under the Old Covenant in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8, here's a couple of three negligence laws. In Exodus 21, verse 22, if men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit departs from her, she miscarries, and yet no mischief fall, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him. He shall pay as the judges determine. It's a negligent statute. You know, two guys are fighting over here and some woman gets into the fray for some reason and they cause her to miscarry. That's why we have homeowners insurance. You know, that's why, you know, if you've got a neighbor and she comes over and visits and she slips on the sidewalk and falls down and she miscarries and she sues you because you didn't put salt on the sidewalk or shovel the snow, we don't want to be responsible for her miscarriage, do we? That's what God requires. I know it's crazy. That's why I've said that God had his head up his rear end. And thank God, you know, for legislators and presidents and insurance companies that came along and fixed God's mistakes. Here's another one. When we're talking about murder and manslaughter, he that smites a man and then he dies shall surely be put to death. And if a man lies not, or doesn't lie in wait, but God delivers him into his hand, then I'll appoint the place whither he shall flee. That's a negligence law. It's called the city of refuge. See, under the law of God, you don't have manslaughter. You have a city of refuge. I know it's a crazy law, but I'm just a reporter, so I'm reporting these laws to you. And let's suppose that you had a field over here and you wanted to burn it off. And so you set fire to the field and you burn your field off. But it goes under the fence over to your neighbors and burns up his corn over here. And he's got $100,000 corn crop over there and you burned it up on him. It was an accident. You didn't do it on purpose. You were burning your own land. But the wind came up in the afternoon. It was something beyond your control and you couldn't foresee it. And it burned up the neighbor's corn. And so, under the law of God, you got to pay the neighbor his $100,000 or they bore a hole through your ear and sell you to the neighbor until you work it off. Well, people woke up one day and they said, we don't like that kind of law. We don't want to be responsible for our own actions, for crying out loud. Well, up until 1851 here in the United States, we used to practice strict liability. And then one day we woke up and said, well, we don't want this, we want insurance. So Congress decided in 1851 that as a result of the New Jersey steam navigation case, persons would no longer be drawn into ownership of ships because of the liability involved. I don't know what people had done up to 1851. They assumed the liability and paid the damages in the past. But, you know, Congress came along. I would kind of imagine that a bunch of steamship companies went in and lobbied Congress and probably paid them some campaign contributions. What do you think? Well, anyway, Congress reasoned that shipping on the high seas is very risky and was especially so at that period in history. In addition, shipping was the only means of commerce, and the above decision would drastically reduce commerce within the United States. So we're looking at money. So as a result, Congress enacted the Limited Liability Act, codified at 46 U.S.C. 181 to 189, as amended in 1875, 1877, 1935, and 1936, and also the Act of 1884, which covered the entire subject of limitations. The purpose of this act was to limit the liability for the payment of debts of persons who were ship owners involved in maritime commerce. The act specifically gives limited liability on shipments of bills of any bank or public body. I'll tell you a little story here. I was flying on Alaska Airlines many years ago, and they lost one of my bags. And it just so happened that in this bag there was, you know, quite a bit of quite a bit of stuff, and seems to me, if I remember right, there was several hundred dollars that was lost. And so I went to the airline, and I said, hey, you lost my bag, and it's got this stuff in it, and I want you to pay me for it. And they said, oh, no, our liability is limited under the 1939 Warsaw Act, or Pact, or something like that, and so we're going to pay you $150, like it or lump it. Did you know that? Yeah, you see, you can have a bag, and you can say, well, I don't want to check this bag. I want to take it with me on the airplane because it's got $1,000 in it or something like that. And it's, no, you can't do that. The bag's too big. You got to check it. But if we lose it, we ain't paying more than this amount of money. This is what limits our liability. See, under the law of God, they got to pay you for what you lost. And, of course, nobody wants to do that. I mean, you want to drive an automobile, but you don't want to be responsible for $1 million worth of damage that you might cause. That's why you get auto insurance, because you don't want to be responsible. So America is peopled by an entire nation of irresponsible people who have contracted with institutions and government and a whole bunch of other people out here, banks and so on, to take that responsibility away from them. You know, you don't want to be responsible for providing for your own old age, do you? I mean, you know, we all get old, and I'm an old man now, and gosh, I can remember 40 years ago when I was a young man, but now I'm an old man, and I provided for my old age. I'm capable of doing that. I'm one of the few people that doesn't have Social Security, and I was able to provide for my own old age and retirement and et cetera. Now, I'm not retired. I'm working harder today than I ever worked in my life, and I hope to work to be 110. But I'm not a burden on anybody else. I didn't go to the government and say, gee, when I get to be 65, I'm going to be old and full of years, and I won't be able to take care of myself, and I need a guardian to take care of me. That's what all you old folks on Social Security are doing. You're on the dole. You're saying, I can't take care of myself. I got to have government do that for me. Now, maybe you don't believe that, but then, you know, everybody's entitled to his own belief. That's the way the law sees it. So when you have a Social Security account, the law sees you as being incompetent. You're just legally incompetent and unable to manage your affairs, and so that's why you've got guardians out there. They tell you when to come in, when to go out, when to get up, when to go to bed, and what to do in between. That's what policemen and OSHA inspectors and EPA guys are all about. And I used to complain really bitterly about OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, and the IRS, and everybody else. I haven't had a complaint for 20 years. I'm not complaining about any government or government officials. I'm not complaining about the airlines and Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. I don't have a problem with any of it. I don't participate in it. I'm not complaining about the mafia. I'm not complaining about the Bank of America and credit cards and all these complaints that people have. Nobody is stealing my identity. I don't care what anybody does with my name and address and phone number and the rest of it. I don't have any credit and I don't have any identity. I'm a non-entity. I'm a common law free man and happy as a clam at high tide. I wasn't always that way, but when I was irresponsible and institutionalized and unable to take care of myself, I was always complaining about my guardians and about the way they were treating me and the way they handled my money and the way they fed and clothed and housed me. I was always complaining about the institution. Once I got my freedom, I got out of the mental hospital. Once I got my freedom back, now I don't have any complaints anymore. I can take care of myself. But back in 1848, Congress woke up one day and said, well, we don't think that Americans can be responsible and competent. It costs too much. So we need to codify the Limited Liability Act of 1851. And the purpose of the act was to limit the liability for the payment of debts of persons who were ship owners involved in maritime commerce. Now, boys and girls, you have automobiles. See, you know, some guy will say, well, I don't own a ship, but you own an automobile. You own a house. And you can't finance that house without getting insurance. You can't buy that automobile and operate it without getting insurance. And Congress wanted to make sure that all you ship owners, all you people that own vessels, you know, like airplanes, automobiles, houses, that you get insurance. So after the Limited Liability Act was enacted in 1889, the U.S. Supreme Court in Butler versus Boston and Savannah Steamship Company, cited at 130 U.S. 527, ruled as followed. Here's what they had to say. Quote, "It is enough to say that the rule of limited responsibility is now our maritime rule. And it is the rule by which, through the act of Congress, we have announced that we purpose to administer justice in maritime cases. The rule of limited liability prescribed by the Act of 1851 is nothing more than the old maritime rule administered in courts of admiralty in all countries except England from time immemorial. And if this were not so, the subject matter itself is one that belongs to the Department of Maritime Law." Maritime law. So if you patriots out there are complaining about maritime law, it's because you have insurance. It's because you're not responsible for your actions. And indeed, you probably do not want to be responsible for your actions. Most people do not. Now, if you should ever change your mind and wake up one day and say, well, gosh, maybe being responsible for my actions wouldn't be the end of the world. Maybe I should try individual responsibility as opposed to insurance. You know, maybe it's a wild new concept, but maybe you might be happier with it. Why don't you call the law school and ask for a free general law CD package, and let me tell you a little more along that line, tell you a little more about the subject matter and all. And maybe the Ten Commandments and the law of God aren't as bad as you had envisioned them to be. I know I didn't think they were very good either, and then I got to thinking about the consequences of insurance. I used to run a company, and I had insurance. We paid $6,000 a year for insurance coverage, which wasn't a lot of money when you compare that to the gross sales, about $1 million a year. And about every 6 months, or maybe it was once a year, I don't remember, the insurance company would send a guy in. And it was the same guy for several years. He was a little guy, wore glasses, bald head, probably in his 60s. Yeah, little inspector guy. And he'd come in here with his clipboard, and he'd say, well, I'm from the insurance company, and I'm here to inspect. And he'd go all over the plant. See? And he'd come back, and he'd have 14, 15 things that he'd seen. He wrote that down. And he said to me, now, Mr. Gordon, I've been through the plant, and I inspected everything. And you've got this rope on this door that's broke, and you've got this rags over here under the stairs, and that's not good. And he'd give me this list of things. He said, now I'm going to come back in 2 weeks, and I'm going to inspect this again. And if all of these things are fixed, I'm going to recommend that your insurance premium not be raised. But if I come back and find that these things are still a problem, then we're going to have to raise your premiums commensurate with the risk that these violations create. So we get real busy and go around and fix all those thingies so our insurance wouldn't go up. Now, there's a guardian ward relationship. See, I'm not smart enough to go around my factory and take care of the particular fire dangers. Well, I had to have this inspector come in there and take care of that for me. He had to come in there and inspect and say, this is dangerous and you need to fix this. See, when you have insurance, you don't have to be responsible. Somebody else is. And so the guy that's responsible, he's real concerned about your building burning down. So I remember another example I was having a few drinks down at Jake's. And one of my old business buddies, Colin, was there. And he says, hey, Gordon, you better call a cab to drive you home. You're too drunk to drive. And I said, well, I'm certainly too drunk to walk. No doubt about that. But I said to Colin, I said, now you can rest assured. You see, I have an insurance policy that covers me for $500,000. Boy, that was a hellacious policy back in those days. That's 30 years ago. That was 1980. Well, probably about 1978, 79, 80, along there. And $500,000 is just a hellacious big policy. And I said, I don't think that I can cause $500,000 worth of damage in 16 blocks That's how far it is from Jake's to my house. 16 blocks. I think I can get in my car, drive 16 blocks without causing $500,000 in damage. So I went out, got in my car, and sure enough, I could drive 16 blocks, and I didn't cause any damage at all. Is that very responsible? Well, of course it isn't. But then I wasn't responsible. The insurance company was. Now, can you see why the insurance company goes to the legislature and gets drunk drivers legislation enacted to cover all those people that are insured that are irresponsible? Now, I don't have any insurance today. Thank God I don't have any insurance. And I'm personally responsible for all the damages that I cause. That being the case, I have to be very careful that when I drive 16 blocks, I don't cause any damage at all, because I got to pay for every damn dollar's worth that I cover. Every dollar's worth I cost, I got to pay it. Personally. Now, I happen to have a piece of ground over here that's worth about, I don't know, 400,000 Fed notes, they tell me. So, I pledge that as a bond. See, I got a property bond over here. So, I got this property bond in place of insurance. And so I've got the resources to cover, you know, $400,000 worth of damages today. And if I didn't have that, still wouldn't be a problem because, you know, if you're 25, 30 years old, you've got your labor for the rest of your life that you're going to pledge as a personal recognizance bond. I mean, that's what bond servant is all about. Bond servant. So you can practice bond servitude, or you can practice limited liability. Limited liability is the law of America. It's the law of our nation. We decided that's what we wanted to do. That's what we did. And, of course, it has cause and effect ramifications. We don't want to practice the law of God, so we want to pay the policies, and we want the regulation that comes with it. We want Ranger Rick to tell us when to get up, when to go to bed, and what to do in between. Now, that's what happens to you when you can't govern yourself. You have to be governed by somebody else. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember that The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this network or radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial reviews, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the common law. Where does it come from? What are its attributes? Who thunk it up? What's good about it? What's bad about it? And why is it that so many people complain about it or its lack, one or the other? Let's take a look at Tontine Insurance. While we're on the subject of insurance, Social Security is a Tontine Insurance Scheme. Tontine Insurance Scheme. In order to evade the usury laws, which had prevented the growth of a funded system of national insurance, governments had frequently resorted to the issue of annuities and child endowments as a means of raising funds. Now, the Tontine was a somewhat later development, having been put into operation in France during the year 1689. It took its name from that of its originator, Lorenzo Tonti, a Neapolitan or Neapolitan banker who was attracted to Paris by the regime of Mazarin and who introduced the system into France. Now, in its original form, the Tontine was a loan. It was a loan in which the premium was never to be repaid, but the entire interest on the loan was to be divided each year among the survivors or the original subscribers. The chief characteristic and trademark of Tontine or Tontine is that the pool of assets is divided among the survivors at the options of those subscribers who dropped out or did not survive until the time for distribution had arrived. Now, that's also called a wagering policy, just like the George Rapp Harmony Society. Well, the Equitable Life Insurance Company in 1868 introduced the deferred dividend system, which was really an application of the Tontine or Tontine principle. The most serious flaw in the deferred dividend system was the inability of the insured to compel an accounting. The general rule is that the policyholder is not entitled to compel the company to account for dividends, nor can the policyholder compel the distribution of the surplus fund in any other manner, at any other time, or in any other amounts than provided for in the contract. All right. Let's take a couple of examples. The Federal Reserve System is called an eleemosynary trust. Eleemosynary is a religious trust which specifically prohibits any accounting. The Federal Reserve has never been accounted, never been audited, and it's never going to be. It's against the law. And it's a Tontine wagering scheme. And the people that are going to benefit from it are the subscribers to the stock of the Federal Reserve System. You and I get to pay for it. I used to pay for it. I stopped. I got out of the Federal Reserve System when I got out of Social Security. Remember, God told us to use just weights and balances. He says, don't let an unjust weight or balance come into your bag. Thou shalt not steal. And as a result of that, I dropped out of insurance. I dropped out of the wagering policies. And that's, after all, what insurance is all about. Insurance is about gambling. Insurance is about a wager. Now, I know that your insurance policy says this isn't a wagering scheme, this is insurance. And I know your state legislature has enacted moral and righteous-sounding statutes and laws and tell us that insurance is not wagering. But let's think about it logically. I had a house up in Boise, Idaho, and I lived four blocks from Joe Albertson. I lived on the first bench. I lived where all the rich people lived. I was called a prominent Boise businessman in the Idaho Statesman one time when I was arrested for driving without a driver's license. And it said, prominent Boise businessman, jailed, no driver's license. God drove my first wife nuts. What would the neighbors think? She said. What would the neighbors think? Now, in my house, at that time, it was valued at about $100,000. That was a lot of money. $100,000. And, of course, we had insurance on the house, and it cost us about $500 a year. You know, homeowners and fire and theft and wind and damage and flood and, you know, all these various little riders that go on here. And so, $500 a year. Now, if I pay this $500, and a tornado comes through, knocks my house down, I'm covered. They're going to write me a check for $100,000. And if a fire burns my house to the ground, well, they're going to rush out there and they're going to write me a check for $100,000 so I can rebuild my house. And after all, that's the purpose for insurance, isn't it? That's what we're told. That's what we believe. We went to school. We put underarm deodorant on. We all believe that. Now, the odds are what? $500 against $100,000. That's 200-1 odds. So what it boils down to is, the insurance company says, well, would you like to have coverage on your house? Because after all, there could be a hurricane, a tornado, a fire, a flood, wind damage. There could be something that happens. And if it were to destroy your home totally, we would write you a check for $100,000 if you pass a $500 premium. We're going to bet you. We're going to bet you. Look at how the bet goes. We're betting you that your house is going to burn down and it's going to cost you $100,000 to rebuild it. Now, we're both in agreement that it's going to cost $100,000 to rebuild this house. And the insurance company says for your premium of $500, we'll give you $100,000 worth of coverage. That's 200-1 odds. I'm betting that the house is going to burn down. Here's my $500. My house is going to burn to the ground this year, and I want you to write me a check for $100,000 when it does. 1 year goes by and my house didn't burn down. They didn't write me a check for $100,000, but they had my $500. So I said, here, let me give you another $500. I bet it's going to burn down this year for sure. The year went by and it didn't burn down. Now they're in me for $1,000 and my house didn't burn down. And they come along and say, well, we'll bet you $100,000 that a tornado or a fire or something is going to destroy your house. Give us another $500. So I said, well, you know, you guys are into me for $1,000. Here's another $500. I'll bet you this year is the big year. This is the year I'm going to collect that $100,000 bet. My house surely is going to burn down this year. Another year goes by and the damn thing doesn't burn. Well, about this time, I got to thinking about the statistical odds. In other words, the insurance company is betting me 200-1. They're willing to give me 200 times the amount of the premium if my house burns down. So I naturally got to wondering, does the insurance company know something that I don't know? Do these guys, are they smarter than I am? Do they know something about this that I ought to know? And so I got to doing a little research, and I found out that the last time a house had burned to the ground in Boise, Idaho, was in 1957. When I did this research, it was around 1980. So that was 67, 77. It was about 25 years ago that a house had burned down. Now, I took a look around, and there was about 105,000 people lived in Boise in 1980, and that meant that there was about, you know, probably 25,000 houses. There are four people to a house, let's assume. 25,000 houses. The last one burned to the ground in 1957. The chances of a house burning down to the ground, total loss, $100,000, isn't very good. Well, at least not in Boise, Idaho. To complicate the problem, I was within 6 blocks of 4 firehouses, one on Americana, one on Fairview, one on Orchard. Yeah, I mean, you know, I had all these fire departments. Now, here was another crazy part. I'm paying $500 a year in taxes so that the city can build fire departments. So that if my house does catch on fire, they're going to send a fire truck out there to put out the fire. So I discovered that the average fire in Boise, Idaho is $14,000 and occurs in the kitchen. Kitchen fires, they call them. And furthermore, you have to have your house fully insured for the whole $100,000, because if you only insured it for $14,000 and your house was worth $100,000, they'd only pay you $1,400, 10%. How do you like that? So you had to have full coverage, had to pay the full $500. But your house isn't going to burn down. It's only going to have a $14,000 loss. And that only happens once a week. There's only 52 fires a year in Boise, Idaho. It's one a week. 52,000. I mean, not out of a town of 105,000. About 25,000 houses. So I said, wow, the insurance company, hey, these guys have a gold mine. Because, you know, if you get 25,000 houses, just try that out, 25,000 houses, and they're paying $500 each, that's $12.5 million. Isn't it? What, 3.6? Yeah, $12,500,000 a year in premiums. And they're paying out how much? 52 fires times 14,000. $728,000. So they're taking in $12 million and then paying out $750,000. Wow. That's better than 13 to 1, 14, 15 to 1. Yeah, that's insurance. Now, insurance is very, very profitable business. I was an insurance adjuster when I was a kid back in the 60s. And I discovered then that the insurance companies were paying out 5 cents for every dollar worth of premiums they took in. That's your auto insurance. Auto insurance. You know, every dollar's worth of premiums you pay, the insurance company in 1965 was paying out 5 cents in claims. And do you know their costs have doubled? Yeah, from 1965 to 2005, doubled. Now they're paying out 11 cents out of every premium dollar to claims. That's why the insurance industry, insuring automobiles, has been up in arms and trying to get, you know, no-fault insurance and trying to do something to stem the loss, the flow, the hemorrhage of the losses. My God, it's doubled from a nickel to a dime. Their cost. Now let's talk about insurance in a more pragmatic point of view. Insurance, if it's good for the insurance company, ought to be good for you. So I'm self-insured. I have the Gordon Insurance Company. And I insure the Gordon house and the Gordon cars and the Gordon this and the Gordon that. Everything that belongs to George Gordon, I insure it personally. As stated in the report of the Armstrong Committee, the plan of deferring, this is Tontine Insurance. As stated in the report of the Armstrong Committee, the plan of deferred dividends for long periods has undoubtedly facilitated large accumulations, providing abundant means for doubtful uses on the one hand, while concealing on the other the burden imposed upon the policyholders. Anybody ever tell you what the profit margin in insurance was? 90%? Anybody ever explain that to you? And the insurance companies, they just cry like stuck pigs in a slaughterhouse, don't they? About their costs? Now, according to George L. Armhein, instructor of insurance at the University of Pennsylvania, he said, quote, deferred dividends were prohibited by law in the legislation in Pennsylvania in 1906 and subsequent years. Thus came to an end a system which in 1898 had superseded to a very large extent that of annual dividends and which in 1915 seemed antiquated. According to Mr. Arnhein, it was outlawed in 1906 but didn't seem antiquated until 1915. John K. Tarbox, the Commissioner of Insurance for the state of Massachusetts, had this to say about Tontine in his annual report. He said, quote, the false idea of life insurance as investment begat the equally false conception of life insurance as a bet, and the latter gave birth to the modern Tontine, which is a wager. In the Tontine, the forfeitures go to enrich the individual survivors of the special class of policyholders who enter into the compact, constituting a company liability instead of a company asset, for the protection of its policy obligations. The stake played for rather than the game itself constitutes the chief offense. Our law condemns, forbids, and makes void the contract of forfeiture. Now, Social Security is a Tontine wagering scheme, and it's a contract of forfeiture. It's obvious that everybody can't collect what he paid in. I mean, because you're not going to pay in as much as you're going to draw out. So it's a Ponzi Tontine wagering scheme. It's a scheme that only government could put together. No private insurance company would be allowed to put together a Ponzi Tontine wagering scheme. I mean, the Tontine is bad enough, but a Ponzi on top of it? Now, aside from the moral quality of the matter, concerning which I waive controversy, the considerations which the public aspect seems to me principally to invite are these. First, whether it is prudent to make of our insurance companies great banking establishments, and second, whether an institution organized as a life insurance system was for a benevolent and unselfish use shall be combined with enterprises of selfish speculation, as the Tontine undeniably is. I am strongly persuaded, Tarbox went on to say, of the impolicy and positive danger of magnifying the banking feature of life insurance institutions to accommodate modern plans of Tontine speculation and endowment investment. So, clear back at the turn of the century, and we're talking about 100 years ago, we recognized that these insurance companies were a ripoff. Now the insurance companies are into banking and the banks are into insurance. And that's because the two most criminal and profitable enterprises that you can get into is banking and insurance. Both of them prohibited by the laws of God. Banks and banking deal with collateral and insurance, which is strictly prohibited in the scripture. And insurance deals with limited liability, which is strictly prohibited in the scripture. Now, of course, we came along and we said, well, we'll fix that. God's got his head up his wrong end. So what we're going to do is we're going to come up with an insurance program and a banking system like the Federal Reserve and the National Association of Insurance Underwriters so that we can correct God's mistakes. And so we've been working on that very diligently for more than 100 years. Now, the outgrowth of that is Social Security. Now, on the one hand, you got the president telling you that Social Security is upside down, and the other gang over here is telling you, oh no, it isn't going to be upside down for another 40 years. I heard one guy, I think it was Ted Kennedy, he was on the air and on television, he said, hell, Social Security is fine for another 10 or 15 years, and then we're going to be drawn off of those bonds that are in there, and that'll take it to 2042. And even in 2042, it'll be able to pay 75% of its obligations. There's no crisis with Social Security. That's Ted Kennedy. Gosh, I didn't know that. I thought to myself, well, gee, that being the case, why don't you go down to the bank and tell them, hey, gee, there's no problem here. No problem. I can pay 75% of my house payment this month. Go down to your car dealer and tell them, hey, no problem. Hey, I'm not insolvent. I can pay 75% of my obligation. See how far that gets you. I thought that insolvent meant when you couldn't make your monthly payments as agreed on. Well, I guess it's the new interpretation or the new spin. I guess they call that spin, the new lies that they tell out of Washington. Social Security's got this trust fund since 1983 when the Reagan administration and Congress got together and they raised the rates to 16%, and they've been running a surplus, and of course the government's been taking the surplus out and spending it every year, haven't they? So they got these bonds in there. Excuse me. I think there's $3 or $4 trillion worth of bonds in there by now. Something like that. I'd say it's a pile of money. Excuse me, if the money's already been spent, all you got in there is a 3x5 card that says the United States government owes the Social Security Administration $4 trillion. Boys and girls, if the money's already been spent, then obviously you're going to have to raise taxes to cover that, aren't you? So when the baby boomers are retiring now, you know, starting in the year 2008, in the year 2017, you run out of cash. So then you're down to the bonds. Now, how are you going to redeem those bonds, boys and girls? Isn't that kind of insolvent? Now, don't let me get in the way of your insurance programs and your retirement schemes, boys and girls. John Tarbox clearly stated that before 1900, there were modern plans to make insurance companies, specifically Tontine insurance companies, great banking institutions. The Tontine scam had been declared unlawful in several states as the people knew that they had to do something to protect their money. Now, the paper money advocates then brought to the United States Paul Warburg. Warburg, the son of one of the big banking families from Europe, from the House of Warburg, which dates back to the Hanseatic League of Merchants. Warburg sold the American public on creating a Federal Reserve Bank so that there, allegedly, wouldn't be any more panics and depressions. In addition, he taught that such a system would be able to even out the economy by control of the money supply. Warburg was successful, and by the Federal Reserve Act, the American people lost their sovereignty, lost their independence, and lost their common law. The giving control of our credit and money supply to a private banking organization had the result of a complete and absolute surrender of our independence by transferring the control of the nation to the Federal Reserve. What if you wanted to get your sovereignty back? Wouldn't you quit using paper money? I mean, if paper money enslaved you, well then, shouldn't you consider abandoning paper money? If insurance is a ripoff, shouldn't you consider doing something other than buying insurance? I know these are wild new ideas for most public school educated kids, but let's think about it. If the insurance industry is ripping us off, then shouldn't we stop doing business with the insurance industry? If the mafia is operating a loan sharking system and they're robbing us, shouldn't we stop doing business with the mafia? If government is raping, robbing, and pillaging us, shouldn't we stop doing business with the government? Well, I tested that some years back. I used to be a great participant with government in business. And I complained bitterly about OSHA, the EPA, the IRS, and the State Tax Commission until I quit doing business with the government. And I discovered something that was very important. If you never do business with a thief, you'll never be stolen from. So the trick is in being able to figure out who the thieves are. Now, over in Luke chapter 11, Jesus had something to say about preachers. He said they're scumbags and they ain't worth talking to. This is Luke 11, 37 through 54. Now, just take a look at preachers. Second, he said lawyers, they're scumbags and they're not worth talking to either. In another place in the scripture, he had something to say about money changers, that is, bankers. He said they're scumbags and they ain't worth doing business with either. And then he said there's a bunch of people as a class that are called sinners. And he said these sinners, they're all a bunch of scumbags and they ain't worth doing business with either. Now you got thieves, you got liars, you got cheats, you got lawyers, you got preachers, you got bankers. And you got these insurance guys over here, and these insurance guys are telling you that you ought to practice limited liability instead of strict liability. You suppose maybe we ought to start thinking for ourselves, and maybe we ought to start making some changes. I know I did some years back, and I'm not complaining about the insurance industry anymore. I paid my insurance premium, I got my coverage, and I never got any of my claims paid. And you people that just went through those four or five hurricanes down there in Florida are finding out that just because you pay the premiums doesn't mean that you're going to get paid. Well, welcome to Tontine Insurance. All right, we got to break off right there and stop for the day. We'll be back again tomorrow night, same time, same station, with more on the subject of the common law. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call direct, 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. Got to leave. See you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.